From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The pat on the back was not a minute too soon for Donald Rumsfeld. Today, at his year-end press conference, President Bush praised his embattled defense secretary.
First of all, when I asked the secretary to stay on as Secretary of Defense, I was very pleased when he said yes. And I asked him to stay on because I understand the nature of the job of the Secretary of Defense, and I believe he's doing a really fine job.
Not everyone is so sure about that really fine job. A new CNN poll out today finds 52% of Americans think the Secretary of Defense should resign. Earlier this month, Rumsfeld got into trouble when a soldier complained on camera that U.S. military vehicles headed into Iraq didn't have proper armor. In the last week, a small army of Republican leaders, led by Senator John McCain, are saying they now have no confidence in the defense secretary. Over the weekend, Rumsfeld came under fresh attack for not personally signing letters of condolence to families of dead soldiers. But with the president's renewed embrace, Rumsfeld's fortunes may now ride on the attitude of a constituency closest to home, the U.S. military itself, and what its members think of the man who sent a lean army to fight a long and deadly war. Tonight on Point, Donald Rumsfeld and the view from the uniformed U.S. military. We begin in Washington, where earlier I spoke with Tom Ricks, military correspondent for The Washington Post. I asked him to interpret what's going on with the Secretary of Defense under fire.
I think you're seeing kind of vintage Rumsfeld, but it isn't playing quite as well as it used to. And there's a number of reasons for that. On Capitol Hill, a lot of Republicans held their fire while the presidential election was underway. They didn't want to appear to be disloyal to the president. They genuinely supported President Bush. And they thought that any criticism of Rumsfeld or of the effort in Iraq would be taken as a hit on the president, and it likely would have been during the heat of the campaign.
Sure.
That no longer is a bar to them. The election is over. They've gotten their man reelected. And on top of that, congressional Republicans have gone home and I think probably gotten an earful back of those Chamber of Commerce breakfast and the various dinners and meetings they're attending. And they're hearing, I think, a lot of anxiety about Iraq. This is still an operation that really concerns a lot of Americans. On top of that, I think they're probably hearing particularly about the involvement of the Guard and Reserve in Iraq. About 40% of the troops on the ground there now come from the National Guard or the Army Reserve. These are part-time soldiers. Used to be called weekend warriors. That's clearly not
no
the case
more.
Anymore. It's one thing when Johnny graduates from high school, enlists and ships off to Fort Campbell, and gets sent off to Iraq or Afghanistan. I think people kind of, that doesn't have as much of an impact on society. It certainly does on the individual family. But it's a little bit different when the high school vice principal or the deputy police chief of police is gone. Because he's in the Guard or Reserve, he's a commander of, say, a civil affairs unit or a military police unit, and he's gone for a year. That I think, knocks a hole in the community. On top of that, casualties, I think, really do knock a hole in the community. People notice it. It's on the front page of the local newspaper, especially if it's the milkman who got killed. And you go, wait a second, my milkman got killed in Iraq? What's going on here?
So today, President Bush stands up at his news conference and says of Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld, I believe he's doing a really fine job. Is he doing a really fine job with all that?
This is an administration that really does not believe in publicly conceding error. It really believes in a stiff upper lip. And Bush has as much said this in public in my colleague Bob Woodward's book, Plan of Attack. President Bush talked to Woodward about how he believed a resolute attitude, taking sort of almost a defiant posture, created a slipstream that if you stuck to a position, people would follow you. I think that's part of what's going on here. They are not going to admit making any mistakes here. Now, inside the Pentagon, I think there's a lot of angst, a lot of discussion among military officers about the various problems.
Well, take us in there, because I must say at this point, whether they admit mistakes or not, there's a reality that's on display for everyone. And everyone's head turned, of course, when the soldier in Kuwait stood up and questioned Rumsfeld. And there the stiff upper lip seemed to turn. Maybe for the, I don't know if it's for the first time, but most obviously to turn on him, that the stiff upper lip was interpreted as callousness, outside the Pentagon, across the country, now feeding back through politicians. But what about inside, Tom? What about uniformed officers? What do they think of this civilian leader?
Well, I think Rumsfeld committed a tactical error in that it's one thing to be dismissive toward reporters. It's another thing towards troops, troops going into Iraq, especially National Guard troops who are somewhat more civilianized than active duty guys. They're not as conscious of their military careers. In fact, they may not even want a military career anymore and been told, no, you're going. And so when they look at Rumsfeld, I think there's a little bit of concern, especially amongst the career officers. I'm thinking here of the majors, lieutenant colonels, and colonels.
Now, do you mean in the National Guard?
Oh, I mean across the military.
Or right into the full military.
Very conscious of the mistakes and problems that have occurred in Iraq. Now, at the same time, they don't like to talk about them publicly. They're very concerned about undercutting American support for the effort. It's a very natural feeling if you're in Iraq that you want the sacrifice that you and your comrades are making to be worthwhile. And so while I hear some officers saying privately that they believe that we wasted a year in Iraq during the entire time that Bremer was running the operation.
Right after the invasion. Wasted why, Tom?
The sense that we went in without a plan in hand for an occupation and stabilization, that we confused a knocking off Saddam Hussein with victory. And in effect, we spiked the ball at the 50-yard zone before halftime came around.
That sounds like an indictment of a Secretary of Defense.
Well, these are things that you'll hear officers say privately. They don't like saying them publicly. And also, for every officer that talks like that, there's probably five who even more adamantly will tell you, no, the media is getting it wrong in Iraq. It's not as bad as it looks. Sure, there are problems, but basically it's a much better situation than the media is willing to tell you. And those guys are kind of so vigorous that you begin to think they're protesting a little bit too much. They're very worried that, as with Vietnam, they believe that the military will be blamed here. They're worried about a wedge, a huge wedge, being driven again between the military and the society it protects.
But wouldn't calling Rumsfeld and the civilian leadership in the Pentagon out on this war be a way of, in some degree, protecting the uniform military from exactly that criticism, especially if the fault for some of this poor planning lies directly on Rumsfeld's shoulders? Much criticism of micromanagement in this war.
Well, I think you're putting your finger on something that I think is happening. That the military doesn't want to take the hit for this and wants it knowing that, man, you know, we're not the ones who screwed this thing up. At the same time, there's another probably even more powerful impetus in the military, which is to salute smartly and move out. Career military officers in this country generally really do believe in civilian control of the military. And part of an officer's duty, perhaps I think the scariest part of an officer's duty, is following orders even when they think they're bad for you and the people you're leading. If it's a lawful order, if it's an ethical order, even if you disagree with it, under your duty, you must execute it. And there's a real pride in that, which is, look, we all had our say here, and now we've got the orders, and let's salute smartly and move out.
Let's look at the top of the uniform military then, where in addition to having the responsibility to salute and move out, they have a job to think strategically. Have they over the years come in line with the kind of neoconservative brigade around Rumsfeld of civilian advisors? Do they see the world in the same way? Do they see Iraq in the same way?
No, I actually think in their heart of hearts they think the idea of transforming the Middle East is nuts, especially with the military of the size we have. But they're not going to say that publicly because they don't want to undercut the president. They don't want to undercut the principle of civilian leadership. There's also another issue here which really informed generals will talk to you about, which is strategy may look simple, but it's very difficult to pull off right. And just because you're a general with a bunch of stars on your shoulder doesn't mean you've got the strategy right. Great example, World War II, Operation Torch, the invasion of North Africa.
Right.
Roosevelt is for it. All his generals are against it. I think history will look back and tell you that President Roosevelt was correct in doing it. You needed to get U.S. troops in the war, and the African theater was probably a good place to get your bloody nose because U.S. troops and the U.S. military needed a wake-up call about how to fight the Germans.
So they've learned from history that sometimes it's worth following the civilian leadership on strategic grounds because they may simply have it better. But what about the reality in Iraq now? Is it piling up in a way that says to them, it's worth sticking with this crew, not that they have a choice, but in their heart of hearts, as you say, or they're fundamentally worried about the civilian leadership they've got.
Well, yeah, as it happens, World War II, we had Roosevelt and Churchill, probably two of the greatest strategists of all time. What happens if this isn't World War II? What happens if it's the U.S. war in the Philippines and you're being led by President McKinley or somebody? Then you have a different problem. And, yeah, there's a lot of sort of quiet worry in the military at this point. Also, we are now 3 years and three or so months into the post-9/11 world.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at World War II, that means we're about at February 1945.
Way into it. Well, you can see the light at the end of the tunnel, big
exactly.
time.
Exactly. You could see the end game. Okay, we're coming up to the end of this. You also had a U.S. military that had been revolutionized in just a few short years.
Mm-hmm.
The atom bomb had been invented. And also, you had whole classes of generals removed and senior officers and officials removed because they were considered incompetent, too old, lacking energy, whatever reason,
mm-hmm.
they couldn't get the job done.
This time?
What you hear officers say nowadays is, you know, nobody's been removed. Nobody's been fired, either civilian or generals. And in World War II, they could get the atom bomb out the door. Here, we can't even get enough armored trucks. There are enough armored Humvees. That's kind of a canard. But we can't get enough armored trucks out the door.
So where does responsibility lie here? As you say, no one's been disciplined. No one's been let go, punished, fired.
And that does puzzle people. There's a lot of criticism inside the Army, for example, of General Sanchez, who was the U.S. commander on the ground in Iraq during the first year there, since replaced by General George Casey. A lot of puzzlement over, well, Abu Ghraib happened on his watch, but kind of they couldn't find any generals whose fault it was besides one Army Reserve female brigadier general. Somehow the buck stopped there. And so there has been a lot of, I think, quiet worry, but what's going on here? Why aren't we seeing accountability up at the top level in the conduct of this war?
Tom Ricks, in that case, what about Donald Rumsfeld and the bigger agenda he came in with, which was this transformation in military affairs, a transformation that was to go right across the U.S. military? Where is he in the arc of that transformation? Has it been sped up or slowed down or derailed by Iraq?
The image I have of his arc is that it's somewhere out over the horizon. One of the smartest guys on the subject I know is named Andrew Krepinevich, and he said to me one day, you know, the Army is transforming, but it's transforming not because of the Secretary of Defense, but in spite of him. Rumsfeld's vision of transformation is widely seen in the military as very technologically oriented, precision bombing, long-range aircraft and so on, long-range stealthy aircraft. And what you're seeing in Iraq is a very different sort of war. It's an extremely low-tech war. AK-47s and RPGs are the weapons of choice of the enemy, roadside bombs. And the responses the U.S. military is putting out there is low-tech. There's few things lower-tech than a big slab of steel. And that's the basic U.S. weapon in this war, the weapon of defense, is their shield of steel that they're wrapping their vehicles in.
So does that make Donald Rumsfeld important to this transformation or an impediment to it? How is he seen?
He doesn't come up a lot in Army discussions of what we need to do in Iraq, put it that way.
It seems to be an indictment again. I mean, at what point, if you look historically at Secretaries of Defense, at what point do they deserve walking papers?
Well, it's funny. Rumsfeld has lasted longer than most Secretaries of Defense last. I think since World War II, when the Secretary of Defense position was initiated, previously you had Secretaries of War alongside Secretary of the Navy and Army and so on. That this Secretary of Defense has lasted much longer than most and seems to like being there. I would be surprised if he left anytime soon. The word that you hear of the Pentagon a lot is probably he will leave at the end of 2005 after this next review of the shape of the military establishment is concluded. There's a thing called the Quadrennial Defense Review. Every 4 years, they're required by Congress to step back and say, what's our strategy? What force do we need to execute that strategy, and what changes do we need to make to fulfill that? The problem right now is you have a hugely ambitious U.S. strategy to change the Middle East, but still the same size military they had before 9/11 happened. And that basic apparent gap between ways and means worries a lot of people.
And I'm sure we'll for some time to come. Tom Ricks, thanks for opening the curtain on all this for us. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Tom Ricks covers the U.S. military for the Washington Post. He spoke with me from Washington. We're talking tonight about Donald Rumsfeld under fire and the uniformed U.S. military he commands. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Donald Rumsfeld and the crisis around him, around how much longer or whether he should stay as Secretary of Defense. Growing chorus of voices from Republican politicians in recent days. Today the president spoke up for him. We're looking tonight, to the extent that we can, inside the U.S. military, the uniformed military, to see what attitudes are there. You can join the conversation tonight. President Bush says the Secretary of Defense is doing a really fine job. Do you agree? And what are you hearing from the ranks? Given the state of the war in Iraq, why is Donald Rumsfeld still in charge at the Pentagon? What do you think? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined tonight from Alexandria, Virginia, by Patrick Lang, a retired U.S. Army colonel, former Special Forces officer, former Chief of Intelligence for the Middle East, South Asia, and Counterterrorism at the Defense Intelligence Agency, and author of Intelligence, the Human Factor. Patrick Lang, good to have you with us again. Thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Nice to be with you.
Also with us from Arlington, Virginia, Pat Towell, senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Analysis. For 25 years, he was senior defense reporter at the Congressional Quarterly. Pat Towell, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
So you've both listened along with me as we heard the interview with Tom Ricks there just now. We've all heard the griping in recent weeks, first of all from the soldier in Kuwait calling Donald Rumsfeld out on camera. And since then, John McCain and then Trent Lott, Susan Collins, Chuck Hagel, a bunch of big Republicans, not the president. But we're trying to probe inside the military tonight and figure out what they think about how they're being led. Patrick Lang, I wonder what you hear, what you know, what's the drumbeat. We appreciate that America's military follows its civilian leadership. That's as it should be, but yet they've got opinions. What do you hear?
Well, I was a professor at West Point for quite a few years, and so I have a great many of my former students who are still on active duty, a lot of them in Iraq. And I hear, in fact, things that indicate to me that thinking soldiers, especially in the commission ranks, are very dubious about the strategy and the transformational process that have been followed by this Secretary of Defense, but that as serving officers, they feel very strongly, as Rick said, that it is incumbent upon them to maintain a brave face upon this in order to lead their men properly, as well as to support the principle of civilian governance in our society. So they're unwilling to say anything in public, but there's a great deal of discontent.
And Pat Towell, you've got your ear to the ground as well and been at the Pentagon, covered it for a long time. You know, we don't want to drive a wedge between the military and civilian leadership. As everybody agrees, that's the way it works in this country, always has and always should. And yet, this Secretary of Defense came in with a civilian crew with a very strong agenda that they've imposed, and some would say imposed at unnecessary cost at this point. What do you hear from the ranks?
Not a lot from the ranks, Tom, but one of the things that has mystified me, Pat Lang is better situated to tell you about what he's hearing from the people in uniform, but one of the things that's mystified me from the get-go as someone who is not only sympathetic but enthusiastic about at least the broad outlines of some of Rumsfeld's transformation initiatives is two problems. A near-term problem is he seems to have gone out of his way to make a problem that was going to be very, very difficult even harder. These are large and fairly hidebound institutions, changing them not just to reach a specific new situation, but changing them to make them more agile permanently.
Right.
As he said, the transformation is not a goal, it's a process. Achieving that change in the armed services was going to be tough anyway. He's probably made it tougher than it had to be by, it seems to me, refusing to give the institutions enough leeway that they could form a sense of ownership. You know, there's an interesting judgment call here. When you've got a vision of where you want to take the organization, how much slack do you leave the career people in the organization
right.
who are going to be there long after you are?
Mm-hmm.
How much slack do you give them to do it their way, even if it means deviating a little bit on this point or that point, so that when you're gone, they have some ownership? I mean, the day will come. I don't know whether it's going to be in 4 weeks or 4 years, but the day will come when Donald Rumsfeld is no longer secretary. The career force is still going to be here. The congressional committees and the staffs are going to be there. Some say they live forever. And, you know, who's going to carry this effort on once Rummy isn't here to ramrod it through? He can get away with ramrodding it because he's got a constituency of one, and we heard from that constituency this morning in the White House.
George W. Bush.
There you go. Mm-hmm. But you know, once Rummy's gone, it's you know, there are people. I'll talk more about the piece of the puzzle I'm more familiar with, and the defense committees in Capitol Hill. There are people who I'm convinced are strongly inclined to support him on the substance of much of what he's tried to do.
Mm-hmm.
And for 4 years, you know, he just systematically declined to reach out to them to try to let them claim some sense of ownership in this process.
You're talking on Capitol Hill there, on the political side.
Yes, yes.
Patrick Lang, what about this transformation of the military? Long discussed, Rumsfeld a very strong advocate of it to make the military more agile. Yet we heard Tom Ricks say that in light of the conflict in Iraq, the secretary is looking like he may not have the transformation that's needed at the moment, that there may be a mismatch between the transformation agenda he came in with and the lessons that Iraq has taught or the reality that it has delivered. Is the transformation still relevant, still needed in the way that Don Rumsfeld came in expecting?
Well, it's a difficult thing, you know, to come in with a theory derived from a bunch of seminars, symposia, people's books, and various think tank studies about what the military ought to be. It ought to be quicker, lighter, and more agile, more special forces-like, as one of his assistants told me one time, which I guess he thought I would find flattering. And it's one thing to do that, but then it's a different thing to, in the midst of the planning for an active campaign, as the present campaign in Iraq, to inflict what it looks remarkably like your beliefs about what the Army should be like upon the force commanders while they're trying to plan the operation. And that is exactly what happened, is that, in fact, over a long period of time in the preparation for the war, the force commanders at various levels were told that they couldn't have as much as they wanted in the way of troops, in the way of tanks, in the way of artillery, this and that. When you do that, then you take an experimental theoretical concept and impose it upon a real-world situation upon men who have to go out and fight a war. And that I think, you run the real risk of both failure as a leader and looking rather foolish afterwards.
So do you have officers sitting in the field looking at what's happened in Iraq? And there's fairly general agreement, I guess, on both sides of the aisle. This has not been well prosecuted from the get-go here. And asking themselves, why is the Secretary of Defense still in charge?
Well, it isn't just him. It's the whole crowd of people that he brought into the Office of the Secretary of Defense with him who were advocates of the various theories, both military and geopolitical. And there are quite a lot of officers in Iraq who are wondering why they're continuing to have to deal with the aftermath of this. You look at something like the Battle of Fallujah, where the Marines, who no longer have any main battle tanks at all, had to be reinforced on the ground with Army tanks because otherwise the fight in the city, where tanks are not supposed to be worth anything according to the new theories, were absolutely essential in order to cool down Marine casualties. Mm-hmm. So things like that happen, and people are not happy about that.
Patrick Lang, Pat Towle, stand by. I want to welcome another voice into our conversation. Freddie Clay is joining us from Bethesda, Maryland. He's a member of Donald Rumsfeld's Defense Policy Board, the Pentagon's Defense Policy Board. He's former Undersecretary of Defense for Policy under President Ronald Reagan. Freddie Clay, thanks for being with us tonight.
Pleasure.
So here you've got a Secretary of Defense. He's got a very difficult conflict in Iraq. He's been taking flak directly from the troops on camera. Now he's got Capitol Hill peeved. And maybe some, we're hearing tonight, some disgruntlement within the officer corps itself. What's your advice to Donald Rumsfeld tonight? You're on the policy board. What do you tell him? Should he hang in there? Should he?
Well, yes, he should, obviously, as Senator Lugar put it so well. Let's keep in mind only two or three, maybe four senators have been criticizing him. That's a small number out of 100.
Small, nevertheless. His own party and fairly prominent.
So about two in his own party and two in the other party.
Mm.
We have to keep separate the transformation, which is a long-term process, an uphill struggle with immense opposition, as was mentioned, in the committees, and also industry. Industry has a big interest and successfully, through their lobbies, can maintain their favorite expensive projects.
Right, so no one wants their ox gored, but can you really keep these things separate? Because we've just been hearing many people are interpreting Iraq.
Transformation is a different time scale. It's a matter of 20, 40 years.
But many people are interpreting the invasion of Iraq as having been...
This is here and now, and it deserves top attention right now. It's of utmost importance. That's not the transformation.
But did Secretary Rumsfeld err in applying this model of a more agile light force in Iraq?
He is applying it to the long term.
Tom, I think there are
aspects. Lacking in Iraq is additional forces at this time. But that is because the power of this insurgency was not predicted by the intelligence.
But you know, there was General Shinseki and others who asked for a much heavier force to go into Iraq from the top, and that was denied by
Secretary. He did, and others wanted the force they went in with, General Franks, and he didn't want to wait longer to build up a larger force, and there's some reason behind that, which he articulated well. Saddam Hussein was ready to blow up all the oil fields if he had waited longer. Thanks to moving in faster, which meant moving in with a smaller force, the oil fields were largely protected.
Pat Towle, here's Freddie Clay. He serves on the Defense Policy Board, so he's in the circle around Donald Rumsfeld, and he says this is the way it had to be.
I think it's important, Tom, to distinguish. We're talking, we can slip into talking as though there's either transformation or there's something else.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, you know, there are different circumstances. There were facets of the operation, the combat operation. Let's distinguish between the fight against the Iraqi army and then everything since then. The fight against the Iraqi army, no one, not General Shinseki, no one thought that was going to be a tough call. General Shinseki wasn't talking about needing a few hundred thousand people
right.
to beat that. That was afterwards,
mm-hmm.
and he was called on that. Unbelievably so, but there were facets of the run up into the country where pieces of transformation worked brilliantly. The famous sandstorm that some of our friends in the press, the embedded media, interpreted as bringing everything to a grinding halt for
right.
Several. In point of fact, two or three Republican Guard divisions were pretty well demolished by air cover, because they used precision weapons of a type not available 10 years earlier in Desert Storm. And, pieces of transformation in some circumstances seem to have worked very well.
But what good is that, Pat, if it leaves us there, for years afterward, fighting a battle of attrition for which that transformation doesn't seem to be terribly well tailored?
You got to be ready to deal with the world as it is, Tom. You got to be able to fight the main force, to beat the Iraqi army. And we did that very, very quickly, one of the fastest armored advances in the history of mechanized warfare. The problem is you also needed to be ready for some of the old-fashioned stuff for which the number of boots on the ground matters. Now, what has saved all of our bacon, not just Rumsfeld, mm-hmm. is that these I'll risk calling them kids because I'm in my late 50s. These kids in camis turn out to be amazingly adaptive. The people in their late 20s, early 30s, captains and staff sergeants and first sergeants who were sent into this thing with no preparation for how you do nation building, because you will recall this administration came into power in 2001 saying we will not do that, we're never going to do this again.
Right, right.
Reality gets a vote, Tom. I mean, sometimes it makes sense for superpowers to do nation building, sometimes it doesn't. This was one of those cases where we didn't. But remember, at the time the war started, we were right on the cusp of disestablishing the Army's institutional memory for how you think about doing nation building, the Peacekeeping Institute up at Carlisle Barracks.
And here we are up to our hips in it. Freddie Clay, let me ask you, quoting here Republican Senator Chuck Hagel of Nebraska, who said yesterday, "I have no confidence in Rumsfeld's leadership," and he said he found it astounding that no one at the Pentagon has been held accountable for poor planning in the war on Iraq. Should someone be held accountable for the planning failures that are pretty universally agreed?
I'll be so sure it was all poor planning. We don't look at the successes. Afghanistan is a success, a growing success. It's barely mentioned. It was planned by under Rumsfeld, too, by his people and himself. The fact that the oil fields didn't all go up in flames was an important success, thanks to Frank's rapid move forward, thanks to the support for that by the Secretary of Defense. There were other successes, and then some things were not anticipated, some unpleasant surprises, namely the current strength of this insurgency of criminal people, terrorists who kill each other, throughout Iraq.
Patrick Lang, what do you think? Freddie Clay says, look, this is well planned. We protected the oil fields. Let's give them credit for that in Afghanistan. But on the other hand, we've got some big problems on our hands here. Should there be accountability in the form of somebody going?
Well, I find it astonishing that the administration figures like Dr. Clay continue to maintain that this operation was well thought through in terms of what was likely to happen after we captured Baghdad and the Iraqi government fell. There were any number of people in this town, including people in the intelligence community, who did their best to tell the administration and the Secretary of Defense that an insurgency was quite likely, given the nature of Iraq. And nothing was really done to prepare for that. So we went into Iraq with a force that was too small, and we may or may not have had something to do with whether or not the oil fields in the south of Iraq were burned or not. But the fact of the matter is that this has not gone well, and people refuse to admit it. Until they begin to admit it and want to deal with the circumstances involved, it's not going to get better.
And what about the call to keep transformation apart from the Iraq example? Are they two different things on two entirely different time scales?
Well, there's a very long-term plan for the complete transformation of the armed forces, most especially the Army, which seems to get a great deal of the attention. And that is a separate thing. But in fact, if you don't think that the sizing of the force for the invasion of Iraq was influenced by Secretary Rumsfeld's inclinations toward the kind of desire to have a smaller, lighter, more agile force that had to do everything exactly right, then you just didn't pay attention to what was going on. And I talked to a lot of officers at the time, and they were extremely unhappy about the fact that their force levels kept being reduced by fiat from Washington in spite of their objections.
Freddie Clay, I've just got Dr. Clay for another minute here, and I want to ask, you're on the Defense Policy Board, Freddie Clay. Can you imagine circumstances in which you on the Defense Policy Board would stand up and say, you know what, this has gone on too long and been poorly directed enough, we don't want this Secretary of Defense anymore, or is that simply not in the cards?
Well, we have a free discussion in that board, as it should be, and free advice. The function of that board is not, it's not the advisor board to the president on nominations and changing personnel.
So you'd be advising, but
it's not a White House board for the president's personnel choices.
Right. And Pat Towell, can you see the president, as Tom Ricks is suggesting, sometime late next year, perhaps changing his tune on Donald Rumsfeld?
The point is, it's purely the president's call, Tom. And one of the things that's going to happen between now and then, far more important than what senators say which, is the risk of significant damage to the Army as it continues to sustain a very, very large force over there, as far as the eye can see, on too small a base. You cannot keep 158,000 people over there, which I think is what the number is going to be up to by the middle of January.
And that is a big number. We've got to take a short break here. Patrick Lang, Pat Towell, please stand by. Freddie Clay, member of Donald Rumsfeld's Pentagon's Defense Policy Board, thank you very much for being with us tonight. Listeners, you can join this conversation when Republican Senators McCain, Hagel, Collins, Trent Lott say no confidence to Rumsfeld. What are the troops supposed to think? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking tonight at Donald Rumsfeld under fire. Under fire in some part from within the U.S. military itself, quietly, we've heard tonight, but definitely some discomfort with the way things are going. We're joined tonight by Patrick Lang. He's a retired U.S. Army colonel, former Special Forces officer, former chief of intelligence for the Middle East, South Asia, and counterterrorism at the Defense Intelligence Agency, and author of Intelligence, the Human Factor. And from Arlington, Virginia tonight, Pat Towell is with us. He's a senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Analysis. You can join this conversation as well, and a lot have been waiting to. We'll get right to you. What do you think? Has Donald Rumsfeld made the best of a bad situation, or has he made the bad situation? And is this no time or high time to switch horses at the Pentagon? What is best now for American troops, for American military policy, for the country? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Arthur is calling from New York City. Hi, Arthur. You're on the air.
Thank you, Tom.
Sure.
I think that I don't know whether or not Rumsfeld should resign or be fired yet. I think much depends on continuing the kind of discussion that you've had tonight. Rumsfeld has made two major blunders in the last couple of weeks, and they're not trivial details, on the number of vehicles that are unarmored, I think that's part of the whole strategy of lighter, more agile, and faster. If you want vehicles that can do that,
the army that we had
is not going to speed them up.
Mm-hmm.
I think the resistance to the question that was raised by the soldier in Iraq is part of defending the so-called transformation strategy.
Mm-hmm.
I disagree sharply with Mr. Clay about 20 to 40 years. It's happening now.
Mm-hmm.
It's resulting in deaths and other casualties.
So we see that front. You've got the transformation intersecting with Iraq in your view, and you, point two, Arthur.
Right. The second thing is this business of not signing the letters personally. The administration has tried to distance itself from soldiers who are killed in action and wounded for a couple of years now,
mm-hmm.
not letting people photograph coffins coming in from Iraq, and generally ignoring the question. In fact, we've had close to 12, 13,000 casualties there in killed and injured, and everybody seems to be aware of them and reacting to them except the president and his secretary of defense.
And you think that reluctance to put his Rumsfeld's own hand to those letters of condolence is of a piece with that?
Personal. The third thing, if I could just add it quickly,
yes.
is that an Associated Press photographer in Baghdad yesterday can easily find the Iraqis who were shooting and killing the election officials, but we don't seem to be able to develop a strategy to protect people like that from now until the elections. Those pictures on the front page of the Times today were really pretty upsetting because the AP photographer was actually there.
The Times and right across the country.
Election officials.
Yep, seeing it and capturing it right on camera. Arthur, thanks for all those points. Patrick Lang, as you listen there, I hear Arthur resonating with your observation, saying these are not separate from big policy positions of this government and this secretary. The sort of lightness of troops and forces, maybe even the reluctance to get involved with signing the letters of a piece with not filming the bodies coming back at Dover Air Force Base.
Well, I don't want to talk about him personally, but I think that his remark to this soldier out there that you go to war with the army you have was a bit disingenuous, because we didn't go to war with the army we had. We had a great deal more in the way of heavy equipment and of armor, tanks and armor personnel carriers, artillery, helicopter assets, and things like this that could have been committed to this struggle. And the decision was made not to do that. And the commanders have had to try to beg and wheedle and suggest as best they could they should get that. I don't think he gave that man a very good answer that way. The other thing is about this business about these people being killed in the street in Iraq. To me, what that indicates is somebody who's been involved in various counterinsurgencies and other places. It indicates to me that those fellows could do that in the street, kill people like that, because there is at least a certain amount of passive support for these terrorists in Iraq. And that tends to suggest that the administration's picture of the insurgency may not be correct.
Of course, they were planning at this point on the calendar to have maybe 25,000 U.S. troops in Iraq. Instead, we've got about 150,000, so a very different picture from the get-go. Larry's calling from Kingston, Rhode Island. Hi, Larry. You're on the air.
I'm from Kingston, Wisconsin.
Wisconsin. Oh, sorry, Larry. Good to have you.
My son was just back from Iraq for 2 weeks. He spent the last 6 months over there and went back today. He's on flight now.
How's he doing? What did he tell you, Larry? What's the report from the front from your son?
Well, he says we need a lot more fighting men. You know, we have 150,000 over there, but only 20,000 or more are fighting at a time. And he says they really lack the manpower, the fighters out there. And when you take the ratio of the casualties and the deaths compared to with the 20,000 soldiers that are actually fighting, we are really taking a beating over there.
So a high ratio, you're saying, don't look at the whole 150,000, but look at the fighting force, and we've got a big percentage of killed and wounded.
Yes. And I'd like to make one more point.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was, a story about the Republican Party having a draft. Well, they should have a draft, but they never will have a draft because some of their kids would end up over there. And that's why there ain't a draft. And George Bush and Rumsfeld will never have a draft.
Larry, your son's in the military. What's his attitude about the Pentagon leadership at this point? Is he still on board with the big plan or having doubts? Or how's he see it?
Well, he's on board. He's an American fighting man. You know, he's 21 years old. You know, he's a strong kid. He's out there willing to give up his life for his country. You know, and those guys, they look out for each other, but they need more help.
And he must have seen Donald Rumsfeld talking with that trooper in Kuwait while he was home, your son. What did he think about the Secretary of Defense?
Well, he thought it was terrible. He knows that it's true.
He knows that it's true. Larry, we wish your son good luck in Iraq, and we thank you for your call tonight.
Thank you, bud.
Pat Towle, there's the father of the 21-year-old who's on his way back to Iraq, flying back as we speak right now. I mean, when you think of these kids, you want to do the right thing by them.
Well, his characterization of the young man's frame of mind, and this echoes something that Pat Lang and Tom Ritz both have said. I mean, the people who were over there, these are remarkable, admirable people. They have made a sacrifice, and deliberately so. None of them are there because they got a letter that said greetings. I mean, they all signed up and said, "I'll do this." You know, the father's characterization of his son's attitude is exactly what I would expect. How that complicates the public debate that the country owes to itself is that let's let alone the 21-year-old kid, and let's go to the 40-year-old or 45-year-old brigadier general. Those people are under terrible pressure to salute and march smartly, partly because it's the norm within the Army institution, partly because the fact of life is that if they say, you know, the wheels are coming off, by God, the wheels are going to start coming off. And what that means is that when folks back here, whether it's a member of the Senate Armed Services Committee or a journalist or somebody in a think tank or a retiree, you know, when we have to discuss this, you ask the general, are we doing things right? And the general is probably going to say yes, sir, and salute and say, you know, we'll handle it. You need to be fair to those people. I mean, you can't expect them to make statements that in their mind would be damaging to the effort and would increase the risk to the forces in the field.
Absolutely.
But the flip side of that is that distorts the basis of information on which those of us back here in the country have to make up our minds.
And even without maybe that coming through unfiltered, we see now, I'm looking at a Washington Post ABC News poll out today, a survey found that 56% of the country now believes that the cost of the conflict in Iraq outweighs the benefits. A third approve of the job that Donald Rumsfeld is doing as defense secretary. 52% said President Bush should sack Rumsfeld. Patrick Lang, we hear again and again from the Secretary of Defense and from the President that they are giving the uniformed military what it wants, that if they want more troops, they'll get it. If they want more material, they'll get it. Pat Towle is pointing to a more complex relationship between the uniformed military and the civilian administration here. Do you think the military is, in fact, getting what it wants, what it's asked for?
No, I don't think so. I think he's right. Mr. Towle is right in saying that this relationship is very complex. First, you have the professional ethic of the soldier, which says that you do not complain and you carry out your orders and you fight to the end, no matter what. And then you have the duty to the Constitution and its position with regard to civilian control of the military.
Amen.
And then there are all these things, you know, and they all come together. So these people cannot really express what it is that they might be unhappy about. So it's up to us to express that. I mean, I'm no longer on active duty, so I feel it's my obligation to state what I think is the truth about this. But I do not expect people on active duty to say things like that at all.
But you're a citizen, and you've got a voice, and we're glad to hear it. Ray is calling from Manhattan. Hi, Ray. You're on the air.
Thank you very much. I have some very fast bullets. One, I thought Bush's press conference was absolutely cynical. He had no respect for the reporters. He did not care about the reporters, and he made fun of them, and they were quite meek. Secondly, I feel that, you know, we're talking about the good German here. The Germans went to war. And the good soldier fought a war for a very unjust purposes, and everything you could say about the good German, you could talk you could say about the tragedy in Iraq. It was not a just war. Of course, soldiers follow orders, but that doesn't excuse the debate in a democracy. Thirdly,
but the debate is our responsibility to have, isn't it? I mean, it's the citizenry's response, and
but we should not necessarily take what the soldier is obligated to follow, because
mm-hmm.
he has few choices.
That's right.
Matters. And thirdly, we have a technological fix here, and that is there is a certain part of the Army that wants to try out new technologies to see if they can fight wars without a loss of people. And this was, in this sense, it's comparable to some of the experimental devices employed in Vietnam. And I would argue that you cannot use technology and at the same time believe in nation building at the same time. Those are contradictory processes. Quick wars and nation building don't match. And I find it outrageous that someone says in the long run we're going to believe. In the long run, as John Maynard Keynes said, we're dead.
In
the long run, a lot of people will be dead. And I think that there's a kind of missing strength in the debate. It has a kind of mealy-mouthed quality.
Right. Not entirely at grips with what's going on day in and day out in Iraq. Ray, thanks very much for your observation. Patrick Lang, Ray points to this potential kind of conflict between high-tech military and nation-building. When you're down in the streets, whether it's in Mosul or Fallujah, and trying to get an Iraqi army and police force out there, trying to get utilities working, trying to clear out terrorists, that's not very high-tech work.
No, it isn't. And that has been the great ungluing of a lot of the theoretical stuff that led up to the war in terms of thinking about defense policy and how you ought to have very high-tech standoff weapons, all this stuff. It turns out that what should have been known easily from the beginning is that when you're down amongst a population that is likely to be hostile, you're going to have a lot of men with rifles and a lot of courage who have good leaders in order to maintain the situation and not to do excessive things. It's very important in this situation not to be carried away by your own anger at what is being done to you by the local population.
But what about the top leadership in that case? Donald Rumsfeld came in with a different theme. Do we have a war that needs a different Secretary of Defense, or does he need to stay in the cockpit? I don't know, until what?
Well, if you're asking me if I wish to express a vote of confidence in Mr. Rumsfeld, the answer is no. I think you could well use somebody like Senator McCain, who would be willing to apply more day-to-day kind of rational observations to what is going on.
And even now, with elections there just a month away, I mean, are you saying maybe sometime later next year, or to pick up on our caller, raise urgency, are we talking right now?
You mean the Iraqi elections?
The Iraqi elections, yeah.
Well, I don't think our policy in Iraq has a lot to do with the Iraqi election. The Iraqi election is undoubtedly going to produce a Shia-dominated government that has heavy clerical influence and some inclination toward Iran. In that context, the Sunni insurgency against that government will continue, and we will still have to deal with it. So we need to make our own arrangements.
Our own arrangements, top to bottom, and a big microscope still on the top of the Pentagon, Secretary Donald Rumsfeld. Patrick Lang, it's been terrific having you with us tonight. I'm so grateful to you for joining us. Thanks a lot for being on.
My pleasure.
Patrick Lang, former U.S. Army colonel, former Special Forces officer, author of Intelligence, the Human Factor, and Pat Towle, senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Analysis. Wonderful to have you as well. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation, and not in a mealy-mouthed way, at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.